also to the secretary. And I suspect we will be continuing this discussion with our third case in this group for this morning, Beasley against International Paper. It's an interesting management problem for this court because these cases are different and similar, so we just thought we would let you all coordinate them as best you could.
And coordinate we did, Your Honor. Boeing and International Paper have coordinated both the briefing and the argument, with Boeing taking primarily the 23B issues. International Paper is going to address primarily the 23A issues, and I think derivatively the B3 issues as well. In our case, like in Boeing, the district court declined to conduct the rigorous analysis required under Rule 23 in favor of simply holding that the claims could be certified because they were asserted on behalf of the plan, and we submit that was legal error. The primary claims in this case are that two of the thousands of investment options that were made available to the plan participants under the International Paper Plan are imprudent and should be retroactively removed, retroactively replaced in the International Paper Plan. And we submit that these claims cannot be certified for three primary reasons. First, the investment decisions that were made to invest in these allegedly imprudent funds were made by thousands of individual plan participants based upon each class member's individual portfolio and risk preferences, which is something that this court recognized in the Summers case. And thousands of class members have invested in these two allegedly imprudent options and continue to invest in these options today. The named plaintiffs themselves continue to invest in these two allegedly imprudent options today, 3.5 years after the complaint has been filed.
Let me ask you this question. I'm still trying to get at this concept of how the plan assets as a whole filter back into these individual accounts. And so the plan as a whole, for International Paper, for example, has a lot of assets, and there are managers who help handle those assets, who invest them as they're directed, right? So you pay the manager a certain fee.
There is a record keeper, Your Honor, that is responsible for, on a daily basis, reconciling the accounts, which includes charging or crediting investment performance for that day to that account.
And if somebody decides they want to move money from fund number one to fund number two, is it the record? It's not a record keeper who does that. Isn't there somebody who does that?
That's part of the record keeper's function.
That's part of what the record keeper does. Okay, and so I guess my basic thought is there are all these assets, and there are services being performed by somebody. So there's a charge for those services. So if somebody decides to allocate, to use a round number, $100 to their defined contribution plan, they're not going to get, you know, $100 worth of stock. They're going to get $98 worth of stock. They're going to get something less because there's going to be a fee, right?
Well, there's no transaction fee, typically. There is an ongoing fee in the International Paper Plan, which is a so-called horizontal issue that was being discussed with Boeing.
Right. That's your 17 basis points, if I remember.
It's more like 10 to 15, actually, and it varies depending. But that covers record-keeping charges like the one you were just describing, trustee fees and assorted other administrative expenses that don't depend on the investment options that are selected by the plan participants. Those carry additional fees for investment management, and those vary based upon the investment options that are selected.
And that's all disclosed, as I recall, to the participants, so they know if they're going to go with fund number one, there's a certain load on it, fund number two, something else.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the total expense ratio is disclosed to participants, which includes this so-called overhead. Let's call it overhead for simplicity. Mm-hmm. And both of those components are disclosed to plan participants.
Okay, so now suppose there was something imprudent about that total number. Why couldn't the participants say that this imprudent policy is affecting the plan assets as a whole, and it affects all of us, therefore, so we want a class action?
Well, it depends on which number you're talking about. If you're talking about the number that reflects the fees charged with respect to a particular investment option, then that is a function of the participant's individual decision. And in the international paper plan, the participant literally has thousands and thousands of potential alternatives. And if that participant selects that particular fund, I would respectfully submit that the result would be the same as it was in the Deere case, that being that a sufficient mix was offered and the result is the product of the participant's choice. Mm-hmm. Now, as to the administrative component, which is the 10 to 15 basis points overhead, there the participant's decision doesn't affect the outcome. And that's charged, as we previously said, regardless of which investment option the participant picks, it is not a function of the individual decision. And it is those individual decisions that cause, I think, certification to be unavailable under Rule 23A. As you recognized, Your Honor, this court in Steinman v. Hicks and Summers v. State Street recognized in an individual account plan that was not self-directed the tension between a fiduciary's duty to act on a plan-wide basis and possibly overrule the individual account holder's individual portfolio and risk preferences. Here we have the preferences of the participants expressed on a daily basis with their investment decisions. And so what this lawsuit and what this class action seeks to do is to overrule these thousands of individual investments made by these individual participants based upon their own risk and portfolio preferences.
I think the argument is made, though, that they aren't dealing with a full deck, basically, that they haven't been given the right package of information, that somehow, you know, I know I'm maybe two cases back, but if it were something like the Telsum situation with Motorola, these people are innocently out there thinking that they're making rational investment decisions, but they aren't.
Well, there is an allegation in this case, Your Honor, that there was one so-called affirmative misrepresentation made in connection with the large cap stock fund, one of the two allegedly imprudent funds. And I would submit that that is a different claim. And if a participant were able to establish that there was, in fact, a misrepresentation that they read and they relied on to their detriment, then they would have a claim potentially for equitable relief, at least based upon that misrepresentation.
And maybe a class of all people who invested in that fund.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that claim couldn't be certified as a class action because it's clear, I think, under both the precedents of this court and other courts, that in a misrepresentation claim, individual reliance has to be shown, can't be presumed. And unfortunately, the court in this case, the lower court, did presume reliance, and I think that was error.
Well, of course, that assumes that you have to certify a class on all issues, and it's actually rather clear that class certification isn't an all or nothing. You can even have issues classes.
That is true. That is true. And I would submit that as we conceded in our brief, that as to 23A, we did not concede certification under 23B1 for the so-called overhead claims, but we did suggest that as to 23A, those claims might satisfy the requirements of 23A simply because they do affect participants in a generally uniform way. But that's, I think, easily contrasted, and I think starkly contrasted, with the two allegedly imprudent options. And one of the second reasons why we believe that it was inappropriate to certify is because, as an undisputed matter of fact on the record of this case, it was established that the participants who invested in these allegedly imprudent options have irreconcilable conflicts among the class members. How does that happen? Well,
this is all your optimal sale date information?
It is, Your Honor. It is. And the way that that was derived was we hired an expert who looked at the investment of every class member in the two allegedly imprudent options, and he tried to find some period, any period during the entire time they were invested in the two allegedly imprudent options, where the S&P 500 fund, which is what the option that the plaintiffs want to force retroactively on the class, where the S&P 500 fund outperformed either of those two options, some period, any period. If he found one, the beginning of that period was marked by the optimal breach date. It didn't matter, and here's the key, it didn't matter whether the participant did better in the two allegedly imprudent funds for the entire time that they were invested in those funds. If there was some period where they didn't do better, then the beginning of that period was the optimal breach date. Now, there were over 1,800 participants who had no optimal breach date, which means that at no time did those participants do worse in the two allegedly imprudent funds than they would have in the S&P 500 fund. They only did better. So their interest is not in just being neutral on the imprudence question. Their interest is diametrically opposed to the named plaintiffs because they have a vested interest in proving these funds were prudent.
So that might have been the case in your situation, and I know there are challenges to whether this expert evidence should have been there, but what about something like what happened to Motorola, where there's this catastrophic investment in Turkey and the stock loses two-thirds of its value and so on. There you have a moment, and you can easily enough see it.
Well, Your Honor, I couldn't speak to how the optimal breach date analysis would come out in that context, but I think you're on to something in the sense that where you have a cataclysmic event and a precipitous drop in the price of the stock, then I think the analysis would show that if there were more than one optimal breach date, there probably wouldn't be many participants who had a different optimal breach date. But here what we have is we have...
And the other thing I guess the plaintiffs say is, don't we just sort all that out at the damages end? You know, if there's been a problem with the way the portfolio has been put together, or the set of options, whatever I'm supposed to call it, then that at least can be adjudicated, and maybe some people get damages and some people won't, but that's very commonly the case in class actions.
Yeah, and I can't characterize it as a damages issue because it goes way beyond damages. As I mentioned, the participants who did only better in the two challenged allegedly imprudent funds would have a vested interest in proving that those funds were prudent. That's not a damages issue. That goes directly to the theory of the case and liability. Every participant, and there would be thousands, who had an optimal breach date falling after the optimal breach date selected for the plan, and this is one of the things that the plaintiffs say, just pick an optimal breach date for the plan that maximizes everybody's damages. But on any optimal breach date on a plan-wide basis, anybody who had an optimal breach date after that point would have the same conflicting interest because all of those participants with the later optimal breach dates were doing better in the two allegedly imprudent funds on the plan-wide breach date. So it's not an issue of damages. It goes directly to whether liability ought to be proven, and there are clear conflicts over that issue.
These are known people. Your expert actually looked at all the portfolios, so I'm wondering whether simply a better class definition might have addressed the problem you're talking about.
I don't see how, Your Honor. In other words, one of the things that is often raised in this context is subclassing. But in this case, we had hundreds of different optimal breach dates, and in order to subclass effectively, you would need hundreds of subclasses, each with their own representative and attorney.
But if you pick sort of the best optimal breach date, and then you just said anybody who netted out better or something, you, in some fashion, you just excluded the people that you've been talking about, wouldn't that be better than doing nothing at all? I mean, I think the concern on the plaintiff's side is plan fiduciaries can be careless with options in these cases. They can sit down and it's not their money that's being siphoned off for these management fees, and there won't be the kind of prudent management that ERISA calls for.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, anybody who has that concern obviously could bring an individual action, but
the economics of that. I mean, really, it's not likely to be a huge amount of money.
It's not likely to be a huge amount of money, but small ERISA claims are filed every day. I see the dockets, and over 90% of the new filings.
You're also in your rebuttal time, so talk fast.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me just close by also pointing out that the 404C defense raises individual issues of proof, both as to whether it applies, and if it doesn't apply, how the co-fiduciaries, the plan fiduciaries, can be held liable. Those preclude certification as well.
All right, thank you. Mr. Mollica.
May it please the Court again. Returning to LaRue, it explains the significance and the kind of oddity of the section that we're operating under, 502A2. At page 253, Justice Stevens describes this section as providing, as authorizing the Secretary of Labor, as well as plan participants, beneficiaries, and fiduciaries, to bring actions on behalf of a plan to recover for violations of the obligations defined under 409A. It's a unitary kind of claim. It means that if the Secretary had brought the case against International Paper or Boeing in the earlier case, we wouldn't be worrying about the issue about whether there were individual damages. The claim would proceed as a claim on behalf of the plan.
So what would the relief be, though, if the Secretary had brought this case? Then do you envision that, say, the companies operating the plans would have had to reimburse the plans for excessive management fees for the funds? Or what concretely would have happened had they prevailed?
There would have been declaratory relief at the outset that certain practices were not prudent or violated substantive parts of the
practices. I mean, I guess I still am worried. Under your view of this, I have visions of the fiduciaries of the plan having to add and subtract investment vehicles practically on a daily basis. You know, the stock went down today for the XYZ company fund, so we need to take that out. You know, and 2 days later it's better, so in it goes again.
But I think, Your Honor, that the developing law under ERISA in this area is going to shake out how many of those claims are going to be ones that a law enforcement agency such as the Secretary of Labor would want to bring.
Yeah, but unfortunately, in the position of somebody who's a member of a panel that's going to have to come up with a result and help that law develop, you know, I feel like we need something that would be accessible to responsible plan managers, you know, clear guidance for people interpreting this LaRue decision, which is a difficult decision.
One thing that appears unambiguous, though, is that there is no distinction between the right of the Secretary, the right of the fiduciary, or the right of any participant or beneficiary to bring that claim on behalf of the class, the plan. If there is a loss to the plan, then a participant can bring it. And all the arguments this morning that are being filtered through Rule 23 are telling us, no, Congress didn't mean what it said. We're going to impose all sorts of other restrictions and roadblocks to preventing beneficiaries and participants from exercising that authority that they were given. So in this case,
it's not uncommon, though. I'm thinking of antitrust class actions. The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are authorized to bring civil antitrust actions, but if private plaintiffs decide to bring them and they wish to do so as a class action, they've got to go through all the Rule 23 hoops.
Well, in fact, Congress passed specific laws about securities cases, for instance, but Congress elected, but as LaRue reminds us, as in Verity and as in Russell, Congress was very specific about the enforcement mechanisms they chose. They did not create different rules for participants and beneficiaries.
Well, once you can get into court, of course, the substantive rules are the same, but there are barriers that are placed for class actions because they're representative actions, because they wind up binding people who are not before the court.
But an individual case brought by a participant would be equally binding. I'm an investor in the International Paper Fund, and I have a claim. I'm going to bring the claim saying they should have never offered it. If there isn't a mandatory class, then that means a participant in another jurisdiction could bring another case, and two judges could wind up reaching opposite conclusions about the suitability of that or the prudence of that plan.
That's an investment. That's the prudence claim for the package of investments.
That's correct. And so without a mandatory class action, we wind up in a situation where fiduciaries wind up under differing standards. In addition, we may even have basic questions like who's a fiduciary. In this case, International Paper is disputing that it's a fiduciary, and we could get courts ruling differently on that issue. And then we don't know what the fiduciaries are supposed to do. That covers the B1 A area. In the B1B area, we have a countervailing consideration that once one plan participant goes forward with one of these claims, the practical effect of a determination by a court that a plan or an offering or a fee is or isn't prudent or does or does not violate ERISA would be effectively binding on them. And so we need a mechanism that protects the rights of all of the participants.
It does seem to me, if you're looking at, say, the fee that investment number four carries with it, it would be possible to relieve one plan participant of that fee and not another one. That's just money.
But it's also a declaration, and possibly a participant could be seeking injunctive relief, which is authorized under 409A, along with an order. Now the fiduciary has been directed by a court that a fund is imprudent or a fee is excessive. Carrying on with the same fund or the same fee could implicate them in further litigation. That's why we need the mandatory mechanism, if at all possible. We have, below, Your Honor, also argued for B2 and B3 certification. So that was preserved. I also would address, both in International Paper and in Boeing, the fact that both cases are fully briefed on summary judgment. International Paper has not
stayed at this point.
Right.
Though.
But International Paper, indeed, has not objected to the entire certification of the class and has not moved for all summary judgment on all the claims. But they have demonstrated that there are common issues that can be decided on, at least as to their defense.
Not agreeing that there are very many of them, but yes, I think they did agree that maybe just this across-the-board fee was.
Well, on the defense alone, then, there are common issues that can be resolved on behalf of a class. The fact that there are divisions among the individual class members is a customary part of all class litigation.
These divisions go to liability, not just to the amount of money they'll wind up getting at the end.
Well, it can be true of liability in other settings too, such as securities cases, where there may be an issue of reliance, or in a consumer case such as the Pella Windows case the court just decided a few days ago, where there are differences among the consumers of Windows. So you addressed briefly, Your Honor, the issue of reliance. It's not. That hasn't been litigated fully below, but we have no guidance from this court other than that a plaintiff needs to demonstrate causation. It has never been specifically detrimental reliance, and so that's at best a gloss on the Kamer and other cases that have been cited. For these reasons, Your Honor, the B1 certification was proper in this case. It protects the rights of all of the participants and should be preserved. Unless Your Honors have any other questions?
Apparently not, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have a minute or so, about a minute.
1 minute. All right. Let me just observe that the suits against Boeing International Paper and John Deere are three of 16 similar suits that were filed at the same time by the same law firm, and I think they're a good example of the explosion in defined contribution plan litigation that's occurred over the past 10 years. The sponsors of these plans have spent millions of dollars to defend against these lawsuits and will continue to do so. The allegations are often sensationalized. These same companies spend literally billions, with a B, to provide these plans to their employees, and the notion that they would deliberately infect these plans with either imprudent investments or excessive fees is illogical at best. What is logical is a likely response if these plans are subjected to continuous class action litigation. In our voluntary plan system, nothing compels an employer to adopt or continue to sponsor a plan. And if these plans become ongoing litigation hazards that destroy the employee goodwill that these companies have spent billions of dollars to cultivate, then these companies will quickly choose other less toxic forms of compensation. Now, I'd like to close by just briefly, since I have a bit of time, addressing the B1, A, and B arguments. There is nothing inherent in a judgment in favor of an individual participant that would require, even if it's injunctive, that would require that to apply to other class members. If a participant doesn't like an investment option and wants that investment option out of the plan, it can be blocked for that participant on the record-keeping platform. The same applies to B-1B. An individual participant can bring an individual claim based on his individual circumstances for imprudence. That judgment would bind no one else. Thank you.
All right. Thank you much. Thank you to everyone. We will take these cases under advisement.